This talk is brought to you by iBiology.org, and this audio was taken from a video available on our website.
Hi, my name is Cliff Brangwen from Princeton University and HHMI, and I'm happy to tell you about some work on the multiphase liquid behavior of the nucleolus. So we've been discussing these membraneless nuclear bodies in the first lecture, I'm particularly interested in these kinds of structures, these condensates within the context of the nucleus of cells. It's important to keep in mind that the nucleus of the cell, that's the seat of the genome, and all of the organization that takes place within the nucleus is entirely in the absence of any membrane-bound vesicle-like organization. So these membraneless nuclear bodies really are key structures for organizing the contents of the nucleus and organizing the genome and gene expression. And they include structures like nucleoli, that'll be the focus of this talk, other things like these transcriptional factories that are regulating expression of individual genes, these PML bodies, which are also playing roles in the flow of genetic information, or Cajal bodies and snerposomes involved in splicing, again, and gene regulation. So we would like to try to understand how these structures form and what role they're playing in gene expression and organizing the genome. So nucleoli, or nucleolus, and if this plural is nucleoli, these are really fascinating structures. They've been known for over 150 years. They're one of the first things that the early microscopists saw when they looked at cells, for example, human cells like these HeLa cells. So the nucleoli are the dark, large dark occlusions within the nucleus of these individual cells. They're really interesting in thinking about this flow of genetic information from DNA to RNA to protein, because they're sitting on sites where there's active transcription of the ribosomal RNA genes. So they're really important for the transcription of ribosomal RNA. And the ribosome is the machine that actually makes protein ultimately in the cytoplasm, so they're also important for this step from RNA to protein. And so the way we think about the nucleolus is it's this membraneless condensate that is helping to facilitate the numerous reactions that are required for processing these ribosomal RNA transcripts to ultimately form these mature pre-ribosomal particles and ultimately the ribosome. This protein translational machine. So we started thinking about the nucleolus, right after the initial studies we did on pea granules that I told you about in the last talk. The nucleolus, as this large membraneless condensate, we were wondering if it could be thought of as a liquid phase separated assembly in cells. So a postdoc in my lab, Steph Weber, who's now a faculty member at McGill University, started to tackle this question using C. elegans as a model system. And this movie shows cycles of assembly and disassembly of the individual nuclei within the developing C. elegans embryo. And what you see is that the nucleolar proteins are condensing out of the nucleoplasm into many of these droplets and then resolving ultimately around the two sites in C. elegans where ribosomal RNA is being actively transcribed. And so work from Steph, as well as our collaborators, Miko Hatai and Joel Berry, led to a mapping where we were able to show that the dynamics of the assembly of the nucleolus can be well described using classical theories of phase separation, in particular this Kahn-Hilliard formalism, which is a kind of a way of describing what is the uphill diffusion that is required for phase separation, to sort of overcome that entropic effect that we talked about in the last lecture. So nucleoli really are a type of liquid condensate. And actually, the first study that we did was in this frog oocyte system to look at these nucleoli and to start to ask these kinds of questions about what they are as biophysical objects and how to think about their assembly and structure and so forth. The Xenopus levis is a really powerful system. It forms an oocyte or an egg that is ready to be fertilized. It's very large, so it's about a millimeter in size, It contains a single large nucleus that's also quite large, about 600 microns in diameter. And inside this large nucleus, there are numerous, actually hundreds or up to 1,000 nucleoli, which you can see in these individual droplets, droplet-looking structures within. And so this was a powerful system for us because we could really start to interrogate these biophysical properties within this large nucleus that contains many nucleoli. And what we showed was that these nucleoli, when we push them together, they fuse. If we start to pull them apart, they'll actually undergo these liquid bridge rupture events, which you see in this movie. And this allowed us to start to measure the properties, the viscosity and surface tension of these structures to really show that they were liquid-like. But there's an interesting twist to this, which is that this liquidity, this fluidity, is dependent on non-equilibrium biological processes that are occurring throughout the cell. And so this is showing that if we deplete the cell of ATP, which is kind of the battery of the cell, then the apparent viscosity of these structures goes up significantly. So this seems to be features of non-equilibrium dynamics that are regulating the fluidity of these structures. And that's why we refer to them as active liquids, a kind of active liquid condensate. In the spirit of asking the very simplest question that we can think of in starting out our research, here we asked the question, if these are really liquids, if these are liquid condensates within the nucleus of this frog, oocyte, then why don't they all fuse into a single larger structure? Why are they remaining as distinct droplets when I showed that if we push them together, they seem to readily fuse? So why aren't they all fusing into one large droplet? And that's clearly a very simple question, and I think it's powerful, and it has led us down some interesting roads. So in trying to answer that question, I want to introduce you to some very fundamental ideas that are important in many areas of cell biology. They're important to think about. So Brownian motion was first described by Robert Brown in this classic and very interesting, highly recommended paper from 1828. So in this paper, he describes the random motion of pollen particles and other kinds of particles inside of a cell and the way in which they undergo a random walk when viewed in the microscope. The paper is really fascinating for a number of reasons. One of them is he's clearly very disappointed when he discovers that the motion he sees is actually doesn't have anything to do with life, in the sense that even ground up bits of quartz and other dead materials undergo Brownian motion. And so he was pretty upset about that. Of course, it's laughable now because we now recognize this as an absolutely fundamental concept that's important not only for non-living materials but also within the cell. This is a movie of particles that are undergoing this Brownian motion, these random thermal fluctuations within a solution of water. And so the idea here is that the random energy that one can think about as KT of energy, that thermal energy scale that we talked about before, is kicking around these particles and causing them to undergo a random walk. Now, there's some interesting mathematical features of the way in which this works that I want to draw to your attention. First off, Brownian motion is different than directed motion. So directed motion is if you're walking in a straight line or if you're driving, in a straight highway and you're just driving along. So in directed motion, we can think about if we're moving at a steady speed or velocity, if we go for twice the amount of time, then we have traveled twice the distance. That sort of makes sense. You sit in the car twice as long, you move at the same speed, you've gone twice as far. And so if I were to ask you about the square of this quantity, what is the square of the displacement, then I would say, okay, well, I just square both sides of this equation, and I have some v squared prefactor, and then I have the time squared, and that makes perfect sense. So if I wait twice as long, then the square of the distance should be four times as large. Now, what's interesting is for diffusive motion, the square of the distance does not go like the square of the time. but it only goes linearly with time. So that's pretty interesting. Then if I wait twice as long, this quantity, this delta x squared, isn't a factor of 4 larger. It's only a factor of 2 larger. And so the prefactor here is called the diffusion coefficient. It's something like the velocity, but a little bit different, has different units. In general, this idea, though, that directed motion has the mean squared displacement, delta x squared, going like time squared, versus diffusive motion, where it just goes like time, you can have something in between in some cases. So in general, we would write the square of the displacement goes like time to some power alpha, which we'll call the diffusive exponent. So what we often do is take movies like the one you saw here with the beads, and then plot the square of the displacement, mean square displacement, or MSD, on this log plot, and the slope then is this diffusive exponent. So you can see, this is actually data from a movie just like that one here, and you can see that the mean square displacement is linear as a function of time on this log plot, and that says that the diffusive exponent is 1, which is exactly what we expect for the simple description of Brownian diffusion. So it's important to keep these ideas in mind in what I'm going to tell you next, because what we tried to do in this system in addressing the question of why these droplets all don't fuse with one another is we asked, could we introduce probe particles into the nucleus of this cell and ask, are they free to move around? So as little probes of the environment, something like the droplets, and asking whether they're free to move around. This we call microrheology. That's a term. Rheology is the study of the flow and deformation behavior in materials. Microrheology is that, just on a microscopic scale. So a really talented graduate student in my lab, who's now a postdoc at NIH, Marina Ferrick, injected small probe particles into the nucleus. So these are inert little beads, microscopic beads, injected into the nucleus, and asked, are those beads free to diffuse around or not? Are they constrained in some way? And so what Marina found is, in the initial study, she said, well, they don't actually look particularly constrained. If I put in really small particles, these are 0.2 micron, 200 nanometer beads, injected into this nucleus, this GV, or germinal vesicle, what she found is that the beads actually seem to be dancing around and undergoing what really looks like Brownian motion, so they seem pretty free to move around. So that, at first, was surprising. We said, well, if that's happening, then why aren't these liquid condensates diffusing around as well? And we said, well, let's look at different size beads and ask what happens. So again, if I plot the mean squared displacement of these very small beads, just like what I showed you before, you see that there's this linear dependence on the time. So the diffusive exponent here I would call 1. But as we go to larger and larger bead sizes, what you see is that exponent goes down. So the slope of the curve comes down and down and down. And so there seems to be increasing constraint on the motion of the particles as we get to larger and larger particle sizes. And you can see that here in the position traces of the beads. The small beads really kind of just undergo Brownian motion, diffusing around. As you get to larger particles, we see this intermittency where they seem to be hopping maybe between pores, if you like. And then the largest particles really are starting to be highly constrained within the nucleus. And so if I plot the slope of those curves, that diffusive exponent, as a function of the size of the particles, I see this very clear trail off. So it goes from a diffusive exponent close to 1, close to simple diffusion for small particles, but for larger particles it comes down. So again, consistent with some kind of constraint on the motion of the particles once they are larger than a certain size, which is something like a couple hundred nanometers, 0.2 microns. So we started thinking about this. So it looks like the particles are constrained by some network that has a size scale that's a few hundred nanometers. In fact, the data that we got in this system looks a lot like some data that other folks had seen in looking at similar bead motion in purified networks that are reconstituted from the protein actin and the filaments that actin forms. So actin forms these beautiful filamentous networks. And if you put particles in there, you saw really the same type of thing, where if the particles are large compared to the average spacing between the filaments, then the motion is highly constrained. You can see here in this black curve on the bottom. And if the particles are much smaller than the average mesh size of the network, then you have something that looks like diffusive motion, as you can see in this top curve. We also see in these data the intermittency of hopping between the different states. So we started to wonder, well, maybe there's a cytoskeletal network like actin that's inside the nucleus. And that would be a little bit surprising, though, because actin is well known in the cytoplasm, but usually not thought of as being so important structurally inside the nucleus. And so we started to wonder about that. Is it possible that the motion of these beads is constrained by some kind of a network? Maybe it's even a nuclear actin network within this nucleus. And so the picture then would be that the small beads are able to kind of move around in the interstices, but the big beads are sort of trapped within this network. So we tried to test that idea, and the key experiment was then, well, let's try to bust up the actin network and see what happens to the motion of these beads. And so we did that experiment, and if this were a live audience, I might ask the audience, you know, what you'd expect. So what do you expect? You can ponder for a moment. If you've been listening to the last few slides, then you would say, well, the diffusive exponent should be 1 if it's simple diffusion. So if it's an actin network and I were to bust up the actin network, then this curve should basically all go up to 1. All those points should be up around a diffusive exponent of 1. So we did this experiment. It turns out there's a number of ways we can disrupt an actin network, and we tried all of them. And what we saw very consistently was in all cases, the bead motion now exhibited a diffusive exponent that was consistent with simple diffusion in the absence of any elastic constraint. So all the beads now were able to diffuse around freely within this nucleus. So it really does look like there's a nuclear actin network that's forming a scaffold within this nucleus. Now, this was all to study the mechanics and structure using these probe particles. The real key question at this point is, what about the embedded RNA protein droplets? What about these nuclear condensates that are sitting inside this actin network? And by the way, this is a picture that gives you a nice visual of the network. You might say, well, why didn't we just look at that picture in the first place? And the reason for that is because there's some controversy around how one visualizes this, and is this really representative of the network. But this is what the network looks like, and that's consistent with all the data I just showed you. So we have these droplets, these nucleoli, the red droplets that are sitting within this network, and apparently constrained within the network. So the question that we then had was, well, what happens to these structures when we disrupt the actin? So what happens to the nucleoli? And so we did an experiment where we disrupted this actin network and then looked not at the beads, but now at the nucleoli, which are labeled in green here. And something I think pretty remarkable happened that we were really fascinated by. So we often were looking at these samples in the microscope where we're looking down and showing movies, looking down, the cameras projecting to a plane like this. But what we decided to do was look from the side. So we're able to make stacks of these images and look from the side. And this is a movie then looking at from the side what happens when we disrupt this actin network. And I'll show you that it's pretty remarkable. What happens is the nucleoli within this nucleus all come crashing down to the bottom of the nucleus, apparently sedimenting under gravitational forces. So that's really surprising then and interesting, because we usually think about gravity as being negligible within living cells. But in this case, apparently that's not true. So the actin network seems to be holding these nucleoli in place, and when we get rid of it, they all come crashing down to the bottom. So that was genuinely surprising to us. So it's also interesting, if you let the system sit for long enough, these nucleoli, when they do come crashing down to the bottom, they all coalesce into what may very well be the world's largest nucleolus. This structure is now about 100 plus microns in diameter. It's larger than many individual cells. And so all of the nucleolar droplets have coalesced at the bottom when we disrupted the actin network. So why is gravity important? You know, why do we usually ignore gravity in cells, but in this case, it seems to be important? So it turns out the physics of this is really interesting. So there's something called the gravitational length scale. It goes by different names. Some people refer to it as a gravitational Peclet number. It reflects the competition between gravity and the random thermal fluctuations that want to randomize the positions of these particles. That's an entropic effect, which you'll remember from the first lecture, where entropy, this thermal energy scale KT, basically kicks everything around and wants it well mixed. So that would tend to have particles that would fluff up and distribute evenly. But gravity, if each of these particles has a mass, wants to pull the particles down to the surface. So there's a competition between those two effects. And that gives rise to this what I'm calling the L sub gravity, the gravitational length scale. So KT is an energy scale. It has units of energy. And mg, mass times the gravitational acceleration, that's a force. So an energy divided by a force is a length scale. And so this length scale is basically the length scale over which the concentration profile decays as you get up higher and higher. Now, the physics of this that I'm describing is exactly why the atmosphere thins out at high altitude. So, if one is on the third, fourth, or 25th story of a building, you usually don't notice that the atmosphere is any thinner. And so why is that? Well, that's because, if I think about if I'm in the second story of a house or, even a tall building, the size of that, the height of that building is smaller than this gravitational length scale for something like oxygen. So I could put in the mass of oxygen and these other things, room temperature and so forth, and I'll get a gravitational length scale that's something like a mile plus. So I don't notice the atmosphere thinning out at high altitude, but I will notice if I go climb a tall mountain or, fly into La Paz, Bolivia, for example. I will notice that the atmosphere is much thinner, and that's because now we're starting to approach or even exceed potentially this length scale. So that same physics, remarkably, is at play and relevant within these cells. So we think we usually ignore gravity within cells because the idea is that cells in general are smaller than this gravitational length scale for any of the structures that we'd be considering. The one change we would make to this equation is instead of mass, we would put a buoyant mass, so some volume times a density difference. In these very large frog oocytes, what seems to be happening is the cell has gotten so large that it's now exceeding this gravitational length scale for these structures, and now gravity really becomes important. We can actually quantify this, and with all the measurements we've done, we can determine the gravitational length scales and figure all of this out and make what I'll call a state diagram for this. And what this shows is that for large cells, here we're plotting it as a function of the relevant compartment, which is the nucleus, but I could also put it as a function of cells, gravity starts to become important as you get larger and larger. And so this is kind of, I think, a really interesting system, and it's a place where there's some fun physics at play, which were sort of unexpected until we started making these observations and this discovery. Now, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and tell you about some other really interesting observations that we made in this system. Now, the graduate student Marina Ferrick that I mentioned earlier, in the course of these experiments where she was disrupting the actin network and looking at how the nucleoli all coalesce with one another, forming this kind of world record size nucleolus, what she noticed is that the nucleoli coalesce in a very interesting way if we start to label, fluorescently label the different subparts of the nucleolus. So this is a movie that I'll show you where we've labeled one set of proteins in green. That's this protein fibrillarin, which is a protein associated with the inner core of the nucleolus. And another set of proteins I'm labeling here nucleophosmin, which is associated with this outer layer of nucleolar proteins. And what Marina noticed is that when she disrupts the actin network and lets these nucleoli all coalesce with one another, they indeed form droplets that get larger and larger, but the core as well, this fibrillarin-rich core within the nucleus also coalesce with one another. So it's as if we have a liquid within a liquid. And you can see that even better in these images. These are higher resolution images within the cell after we've let them all coalesce. You really have this sense that the fibrillarin-rich proteins form a core, a liquid within the nucleophosmin-rich outer liquid. And so this is kind of a really interesting idea, and we start to think about what it means and how to understand it from a molecular biophysical perspective. Now, some other work we'd been doing, we had been able to show that when we take fibrillarin, this core-associated protein, and purify it, it phase separates into these beautiful liquid droplets. And that may be not so surprising based on what I told you in the last lecture, because fibrillarin has significant stretch, which is conformationally heterogeneous, this intrinsically disordered region, which we think are really driving phase separation. And so we'd shown that it forms these nice liquid droplets. What about the other proteins? So for that work, we collaborated with Richard Kroaki and Deanna Maitreya at St. Jude, who had been working with nucleophosmin in vitro with a purified system. And they had shown that nucleophosmin phase separates into these nice liquid droplets in vitro. And so we said, hey, let's just do what is a simple and obvious experiment and take these two samples and mix them and ask what happens. And when we did that, quite remarkably, I think, what we found is that the fibrillarin-rich droplets and the nucleophosmin-rich droplets are relatively immiscible with one another. They do not mix with one another. And instead, we get this, what I would call a three-phase system. There's the dark region here would be a low concentration phase of, it has some nucleophosmin and some fibrillarin. The green puncta inside here are a fibrillarin-rich liquid phase, and the red or sort of orange-colored outer phase is a nucleophosmin-rich phase. So this is really, I think, quite remarkable, and it's remarkable for a few reasons. One of them is that this purified protein system essentially completely recapitulates the in vivo organization of these structures. So in vivo, recall that we have fibrillarin-rich liquid-like droplets within a nucleophosmin-rich outer layer, and that's exactly what the in vitro purified system looks like. So we thought that was pretty incredible. Very simple system of small number of protein and RNA components, we've been able to recapitulate this core shell architecture of the nucleolus. Now, the idea of liquid immiscibility, having multiple immiscible liquid phases or non-mixable liquid phases, is itself something that is well known in chemical engineering and physical chemistry and soft matter communities. This is just an example of some immiscible liquids that one can form from non-living organic solvents and water and oils, where you can get these things that do not mix with one another. So we can have phase separation then, not just of forming two phases, but actually forming many phases, and the way in which those phases interact is quite interesting and sort of a rich set of physics that is yet to be completely understood. One of the questions that we asked in doing these experiments is, why would fibrillarin droplets be on the inside? So in other words, why is the green inside the red? Why isn't the red inside the green, for example? That would be seemingly just as valid. You'd have immiscibility. They're not mixing with one another. From the biology perspective, that would probably be a problem, because the processes that are associated with fibrillarin and the fibrillarin dense condensed state take place first, and the idea is that those RNA transcripts are processed in a sequential fashion inside to outside. So if the order weren't right, then that would probably cause problems for the biology. So why is it that fibrillarin knows that it's supposed to be on the inside and nucleophosmin and those components know that they're supposed to be on the outside? Well, it turns out that a key to answering that question comes from surface tension. So as the name implies, surface tension is a kind of tension associated with surfaces or interfaces between two different types of phases. In particular, it's an energy cost associated with having an interface, and it actually has units of energy per unit area. You can think about this in the simple schematic as reflecting the fact that molecules within a bulk phase are sort of experiencing a homogeneous environment surrounded by a particular set of molecules, but at the interface there's this kind of on one side they're seeing the homogeneous phase, on the other side they're seeing this external environment, and that sets up an energy cost. The manifestation of surface tension is something that we're all familiar with by looking at things like water walking bugs, or the fact that we can some cases get paper clips to actually float on water because of these surface tension effects. Or if you were to wash your car put some wax on the car, for example, and then watch the water droplets would bead up on that surface. Those are all surface tension effects, the energy of interfaces between different phases. And it turns out that surface tension is really well known to be key in structuring multi-phase liquids. So in particular, if for multi-phase systems from non-living matter, we know that that to have this kind of a core shell organization of a three-phase system, the surface tension between phase three, this green phase, and phase one, the black phase, would have to be large. So if that surface tension, the energy associated with that interface is very large, then the system can minimize the energy by making that interface go away. In other words, by having the green phase within the red phase. And then there's no longer any interface between one and three. You can do a very simple experiment. So Marina actually did this really simple sort of experiment you can do in your kitchen by taking water, Crisco oil, and silicone oil and showing that because the water silicone oil interface, the tension, the surface tension is large, larger than that between the water and the Crisco oil, the red stuff, then the silicone oil gets embedded within the Crisco oil. So we had a prediction that that the core shell architecture, the core shell organization we see with the nucleolus was reflecting these differential surface tensions. To try to test that idea, we took the purified proteins that form these liquids and asked how do they interact with surfaces of different hydrophobicity so that we could try to understand the relative strength of their interactions, their favorability for interactions with water versus with oil. And so we took a surface that's relatively hydrophobic. This is not a strongly hydrophobic surface, but relatively hydrophobic. And we looked from the side, again, kind of visualizing from the side, at how these droplets interact with the surface. What we found is that the nucleophosmin droplets tend to behave like water in that they tend to bead up on these relatively hydrophobic surfaces, where the fibrillarin-rich droplets tend to better wet these hydrophobic surfaces. And that's all consistent with the idea that the surface tension between fibrillarin, the green stuff, and water is larger than that between nucleophosmin, the red stuff, and water. And that's why the green droplets are embedded within the red, just like you see in the schematic here. And so this idea of surface tension and surface tension structuring of multi-phase liquids has implications, I think, much beyond the nucleolus, which is the system we've been studying to elucidate these ideas. In particular, if the interface and the surface tension between two different phases, let's say between phase three and phase two, the red and green, if that's really energetically costly, in other words, anytime red is next to green, there's a huge energy cost, then what happens is these two types of liquids just will never interact. They won't touch each other at all. And so that's probably why many of the condensates in cells actually don't interact at all. They're sort of not sticking to one another, not wetting one another, not engulfing one another, and so forth. In other cases, though, there can be partial wetting where the surface tensions are roughly of the same magnitude. And then you can have droplets that are not fully engulfing one another, but they're interacting, and you can have morphologies that look like this. We think this is important because there are many structures in the cell where there's partial interaction between these condensates. For example, in this beautiful micrograph from Joe Gall, showing Cajal bodies and snerpozoans and the sort of partial wetting, these kind of well-defined contact angles and so forth that one can start to use to measure the surface tensions between these droplets and between the droplets and the surrounding nucleoplasm in this case. So in this talk, I've tried to convey to you some of the excitement about the nucleolus and more generally the idea that these condensed states of biomolecular matter are important within the nucleus. The nucleolus is just one type of these structures. We focused on quite a bit because it's the largest of the nuclear bodies, but there are really dozens of different types of these things inside of the nucleus. And in fact, we think that the nucleolus probably is a hypertrophied example of the kind of phase separation and the way in which the condensates that form are impacting the genome and potentially playing a really important role in the flow of genetic information. We can think about these condensates as something like the condensation of water on this spider web that can deform the spider web and actually restructure it in some way. And so those are the kinds of questions that we're starting to address, and there's a lot of excitement in this field in thinking about these ideas moving forward. So how do liquid condensates impact genome architecture and activity? So how might they be playing a key role in regulating the expression of genes that give rise to the traits of an organism, the hair color and eye color, height, weight, number of arms and legs and toes, and all of those sorts of things that really make biology so interesting that we can go from genes to traits. How do these transitions, so that, I've talked a lot about in the last talk as well, about the transitions between liquid states and solid states, these liquids and gels and amyloids. Do transitions between those different states of biomolecular matter play a role in gene regulation? So it's really a fascinating question. We have very little knowledge about that, and I think that's going to be one of the key questions going forward in this area at the interface of soft matter physics, cell biology, genetics, and probably a number of other fields. There's a lot of excitement right now, and we're going to be happy to see this move forward. I want to thank you for your attention. It's been really a pleasure to work with some of the folks I mentioned, Marina Ferrick, a former grad student. We've got a really wonderful set of people in the lab, and I've been fortunate to interact with a lot of really brilliant collaborators. I'm very grateful for that, and the funding that has helped make some of the work we're doing in our lab possible. Thank you so much for your attention.
Visit us at iBiology.org for more free talks from the world's top scientists. This talk was brought to you with support from the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of General Medical Sciences, and the Lasker Foundation.